2028, an aggressive timeline for landing on the moon. Steps getting there, when do humanoid robots enter that equation? Can you give us a few details?
The most expensive part of doing that is not the nuclear fuel, it's not the modifications needed for lunar surface. We all enjoyed the headlines of Artemis 2, but reminded us of what's possible and got us all excited. We don't want to wait several years in between the next episode, right?
I'd be curious to hear your timelines for deploying humanoid robots with your NASA hat on.
Any area that you're going to have human involvement eventually, it would be crazy not to, you know, make a force multiplier and put humanoid robots there to do some of the work.
This is, I think, the question on the minds of many people I've spoken with. Are we alone?
In my mind, I would think.
Now that's a moonshot, ladies and gentlemen.
We just flew humans around the moon for the first time since 1972. We've announced plans to land American astronauts on the lunar South Pole in 2028. Two competing moon landers are being built right now, and there's plans to run NASA, a $25 billion agency, more like a startup than a bureaucracy. And the man driving it all flew to space twice as a private mission commander before even taking the job. I've known most of the NASA administrators in the last 40 years, and in my humble opinion, our guest today is the greatest of them all. I want to welcome everybody to Moonshots, you know, your number one podcast in all things AI and exponential tech, your front row seat to the singularity. Today, my Moonshot mates and I are going to be diving deep into humanity's future in space with our extraordinary guest, Jared Isaacman, the 15th administrator of NASA. Let me take a moment to properly introduce Jared. He didn't come up through the regular route of being a member of the astronaut corps or a government agency. He's a builder. He founded his first company, Shift4 Payments, at the age of 16 in his parents' garage, and then built it into a payments company processing hundreds of billions of dollars annually. He's a jet pilot who's flown in air shows and set around the world speed records. And then he did something epic, purchasing two private Falcon 9 Dragon missions. He commanded Inspiration 4 in 2021, the first all-civilian orbital mission. And then in 2024, he commanded Polaris Dawn, where he performed the first-ever commercial spacewalk, stepping out of a Dragon capsule into the vacuum of space. During his start at NASA, he laid out five key objectives: get America back to the moon, build a permanent moon base, begin using nuclear power in space, ignite a real orbital economy, and reinvigorate the science that lets us look for life among the stars. Jared, welcome to the Moonshots and Moonshot mates. You know, we've known each other for 17 years, and I could not be more proud to have you on the show.
Well, Peter, thanks for having me on the show. It's an absolute pleasure to reconnect. I'm going to challenge you a little bit on that. I appreciate the generous introduction. It's super early right now.
I know it is.
But I have plenty of time to screw things up. But I'll tell you right now, we are all, everybody at NASA, from leadership down to the engineers and technicians, we are having a great time right now. We're moving very quickly. There isn't a person who shows up to work every day at NASA that's not excited about changing the world in air and space. And everybody is just really enthusiastic about getting after it.
Yeah, agreed. You know, you said something very nice that 17 years ago in Baikonur, I got you started on this mission. Is that actually true?
That is. Now, I mean, look, since kindergarten, right, I wanted to be an astronaut like a lot of kids that just look up at the night sky and, you know, imagine the possibilities. I just never thought it was even close to possible or achievable. That's why I became a pilot. And I started undertaking some mini adventures like flying around the world on those speed records. And somehow along the way, you found me and invited me to Baikonur. And it was during that trip I was like, well, maybe it is a possibility. So you absolutely helped steer me down this path. And just so you know, I mean, it's only been a matter of days since I came back from my second visit to Baikonur. I have to tell you, it was very different than the first trip. I didn't have any Russian delegations coming out to meet with me when you and I were on that journey.
Yeah, that was the mission. I think Richard Garriott was flying into space. I'd actually brought Eric Schmidt, Larry Page, and Sergey to that mission, too. We watched the mission from a bunker about a half a kilometer from the launch pad and then went outside to watch. It was like an epic. It was like the thunder of God before you.
Yeah. I always describe it as we were like a solid par three away from the launch pad when we were there. They have moved us back a little bit, I can say, as of this current launch. But still, I mean, I walked Anil Menon right up to the ladder of Soyuz, and then was involved in a bilateral discussion with our counterparts in Russia, 100 yards away. I mean, a building right next to that fully fueled vehicle. So it's a little different.
You're crazy.
Wait, was that first one the one where you said if anything goes wrong with this launch,
yeah,
what happens?
So Sergey was there. We had two or three, you know, Soviet era Russians there, you know, with incredible outfits in the bunker. And when we walked outside, Sergey asked the question, so what happens if something goes wrong in Russian? And the response, which he translated, was like, enjoy, it will be the last thing you ever experience.
Well, that's, I mean, there was plenty of risk before we ever got there. Like, we all had to go on a Soviet Tu-154 airliner. I mean, this is the same plane that I think took out a lot of the, you know, Polish political leadership a few decades ago. So everyone, you know, the entire Google leadership team, not to mention whoever else you invited on board, had some serious concentration risk on that old Soviet plane just even getting to Baikonur.
It was like Eric was saying, like, do not let the media know that we're here.
Well, I tell you, it's so cool to have somebody that fearless running a government agency. That's got to be rare. But you've got the DNA for it. That's real cool.
Jared, let me kick it off. You know, on this podcast, we talk a lot about AI, exponentials, robotics, and have to imagine that living at this moment in the singularity, it's got a chance to really accelerate NASA's timeline across Moon, Mars, and everything else. And the first question is, you know, we talk a lot about the large language models, the small embedded language models that are going into robots and everything. Can you imagine a time when NASA basically allows full autonomy on all of its robots and probes, and these robots and probes, whether they're in Titan or Mars or moving out to Europa, are on their own investigating what's interesting and deciding what experiments to run independent of scientists back on Earth?
100%. So, I mean, we still, no matter what, want to get the data back. It's just, if you have a limited window of opportunity to do so, do you let the on-mission AI make the determination of what is the most interesting data in the least amount of time I have available possible and send it home before perhaps destruction? And there's already a mission designed for that, which is Da Vinci, which is going to Venus. And in that pressure environment, that mission will not live long. So we're designing it from the get-go to have, on-mission, AI, and it will determine what actions it needs to take based on the data it's able to collect as quickly as it possibly can, use it to inform its mission direction, and then send home what's most useful back to the scientific community. So that's probably the first and best example, but just the beginning for where we should be going with this technology.
The timelines with everything AI are compressing and compressing and compressing. So now we're, you know, talking a lot on the pod about speed running Star Trek and getting to that destination in some bounded time frame. But two questions for you. One, AI back here on the ground, how is it accelerating the rate at which you design new ships, new missions? And then also humanoids out in space doing a lot of what an astronaut like you would have done historically. Now you can take a lot more risk if you're launching a humanoid robot than an astronaut.
Yeah, so good question. Maybe just if I can reframe it just a little bit to say, like, what are we doing with AI right now and how is that informing NASA's mission? And I'll tell you one, like, we are structurally very disadvantaged relative to any of the hyperscalers. We're a government agency. I mean, if you think about even NASA's budget, which you said at the beginning of $25 billion a year, I mean, the hyperscalers are investing many times NASA's budget into just, hardware procurement right now. So how do you even be smart, knowing you're at somewhat of a disadvantage at NASA, to get the most out of the capability to further our mission, ensure America's competitiveness in the high ground of space? And I'll tell you, President Trump and with OSTP Director Kratsios have come up with a really good idea, the Genesis program. I don't know how familiar you are with it.
But we are.
Okay, so you're all tracking. Everybody in government is kind of kicking into this.
But the audience may not be, so okay. If you want to hit that, yeah.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, it again, it's recognizing even whole of government, is disadvantaged. And the worst thing possible is for every government agency to throw what little dollars it can at the problem and hope for good outcomes. Instead, it's kind of collecting consolidating resources into the Department of Energy, which, by the way, for a very long time, it's has had some pretty substantial computing power available to it. obviously that even that gets quickly outdated. But they've always had the budget for investments in, you know, in compute, and consolidating your AI strategy, leveraging some data that's very unique to government agencies just based on the work that's being done, and having a whole of government approach to leveraging the potential of AI. And NASA's job, we submitted two overarching themes to leverage the Genesis program. Number one is, what have we missed and what are we likely to miss? That's just my way of describing it. We have collected so much data over the decades from various NASA missions. What have we overlooked in it? I mean, there wasn't just that long ago headlines were made from a teenager in Texas who leveraged AI and went through some archival NASA data and found new galaxies. I mean, that's not something we should generally want to overlook. And we've since extended an internship offer to him, and I think he may start next year. But that problem's going to, I mean, and maybe you call it a problem or an opportunity, is only going to get worse when you think about the constellations of satellites that are going up, even for Earth observation and space weather, let alone new missions like Nancy Grace Roman Telescope, which will launch August 30th on a Falcon Heavy. I mean, you know, 100 times the field of view of Hubble, 1,000 times the scan rate. You're going to be gathering so much data. And then there's so many new missions, again, that will be going up. So how do we just leverage AI to go through this immense amount of data that we have for scientific breakthroughs we might have overlooked or could likely overlook? And that kind of goes to the heart of NASA's mission of unlocking the secrets of the universe. The second category is extending our reach. And that kind of goes to your advanced, you know, spacecraft design. I'm kind of concentrating that into propulsion. But whether, you know, you have on orbit or on mission robotics, whether that's actually necessary or not, what I care about is, you know, overcoming the tyranny of distance in space right now, which, you know, you have, you know, appreciating that we barely even scratched the surface in our solar system, let alone the next closest star system. And industry is doing a fantastic job of maturing chemical propulsion, so from rapid reusability or, you know, like you see the evolving performance that they get out of even Merlin, let alone Raptor, which is very early in its kind of design cycle. How do we leverage AI and go well beyond that and try and unlock a little bit more of the energy potential from matter, which is almost, you know, I mean, immeasurable in chemical propulsion to, I don't know, 0.1% with fission or 0.5% with fusion until we ultimately get to the desired destination of, you know, antimatter annihilation, which maybe actually gives us the real potential to start thinking beyond what's in the reach of our solar system. So those are two overarching themes.
That's huge. Alex, over to you, pal.
Amazing. Well, Jared, I would say NASA has a storied history of human spaceflight on the one hand, and on the other hand, sending lots of non-humanoid robots throughout the solar system. I'd be curious to hear your timelines, what you perceive as the future in the context of Artemis in the near term or other planets in the solar system for deploying humanoid robots with your NASA hat on throughout the solar system, and what role and what timeline you perceive humanoid robots, to the extent friend of the pod Elon has characterized the Optimus as the ultimate von Neumann probe for the solar system. what role you see humanoids in constructing Artemis and other facilities elsewhere?
Well, I think any place that we believe there is a realistic probability of building a, an eventual human outpost. So the moon for sure. I mean, we've been blessed with having this proving ground, you know, three to four days away from Earth. We are absolutely going to build a base there and make the most of it. So any area that you're going to have, human involvement eventually, it would be crazy not to, you know, make a force multiplier and put humanoid robots there to do some of the work. I mean, honestly, like when you think about having human beings on the moon base and saying, well, what's their job going to be? It's like, I mean, the least possible. I mean, really, like it's still incredibly dangerous the moment they walk outside. It's incredibly dangerous to be there in the first place. So leveraging robotics there for all things from infrastructure build out, logistics, is imperative. I mean, you want there to be no alternative but to put an astronaut outside the habitat for an EVA. Mm-hmm. And the same would be applicable for Mars, which is the next logical destination, you know, the next stepping stone on this grand journey that we're undertaking. But there's plenty of places, obviously, where why would we even need to, you know, require a humanoid robot there? Like, we, you know, you think about exciting missions to seek out signs of life or ancient life that could have existed in our solar system. So take Europa Clipper, or I'm very, you know, optimistic that we might be able to commission a mission to Enceladus at some point in time.
Nice.
Or you know, Dragonfly, for example, going to Saturn's moon of Titan. We just need to build the best probe or discovery instrument for that mission to get us the data that we're excited for. And it doesn't necessarily have to obviously take on any sort of humanoid form.
You like that, Slim, I bet. Dave, back to you, pal.
Yeah, I love that split focus of, hey, we have reams of proprietary data. Let's AI it. And then transsolar, you know, nobody in the commercial world, you know, I totally get the big budgets, but nobody in the commercial world is going to work on fusion or antimatter annihilation to get to other solar systems. So that's just incredibly cool. But at the same time, orbital data centers have stolen the spotlight recently. What's NASA's position on orbital data centers? And, you know, it's going to create a huge amount of launch capacity. So maybe assembling things for transolar in space is part of the stepping stone there. But what is the position on orbital data centers?
Well, first, just to hit, I mean, even unlocking fission forms of propulsion, I would still argue would be a major distraction for a lot of commercial industry right now when, I mean, there is so much potential else there, not to mention all the terrestrial applications for fission power when we are trying to win an AI race, which I think is, by the way, just to point out, extremely healthy for NASA. Like, I think the worst thing for NASA is the world's most accomplished space agency is trying to